Good evening, everyone. On behalf of LSE Ideas, I'd like to extend a very warm welcome this evening to the LSE for tonight's event, The Crisis of Global Politics, Lessons from Continental Philosophy. It's become something of a truism these days to say that we're undergoing a crisis in the West, whether it's the unpredictable effects of climate change, the surge of populist and insurgent parties across Europe and the rest of the world, the resurgence of Vladimir Putin's Russia, the election of Donald Trump, and a small thing you might have heard of locally called Brexit. This evening, we're going to ask whether the critical theoretical tradition can shine any light on these topics. We're going to be exploring the works of a number of philosophers from the continental tradition, usually associated with Hannah Arendt, Michael Foucault, and Martin Heidegger. Arendt, of course, in particular, was cited a lot after the election of Donald Trump, but I think there's still an assumption that philosophers working in the critical tradition don't engage with debates in public policy and contemporary politics, so we thought we'd put that to the test in this evening's debate. We're very lucky to welcome this evening five distinguished speakers, all of whom work in the field of continental philosophy and critical theory. And they've come many a very long way to share their expertise with us this evening. And what better place to be at the moment for studying crisis and change than a country where the government is rapidly falling apart and where football is coming home. It's a very exciting time. Let me introduce in the order in which they will be speaking tonight's speakers. First, we have Elke Schwartz, lecturer in international politics at the University of Leicester, and author of the recently published and upbeat titled Death Machines. We have Sebastian Schindler from the Goethe University in Frankfurt. Ute Steiger, executive director of the UCL European Institute. Scott Hamilton, postdoctoral fellow at the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo, Canada. And our discussant this evening, Josephine Graef, who is a Dahrendorf postdoctoral fellow at the Hertie School of Governance in Berlin. The format for tonight's event, each speaker will talk for about 10 to 12 minutes, followed by a discussion from Josie, and then we'll open up the floor to questions from the audience. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy the event, and I'll hand on now to Elke.
All right, well, thanks very much, Ben, for inviting me for this really exciting talk, and thanks very much, all of you, for coming on this really hot day. So in my talk today, I will talk a little bit about, the issue of artificial intelligence and what a philosopher of technology named Günther Anders perhaps can help us in thinking through this issue a little bit more. My research is primarily concerned with technological webs, the technological webs within which we find ourselves, specifically the questions, what happens to our political agency and what happens to our moral agency or ethical agency within this technologically mediated ecology within which we find ourselves, specifically as it accelerates in its progress, progress in quotation marks. So as we become more intricately woven into an ecology of specifically digital technologies, and superhuman type technologies. I think for me it's important to look quite carefully at exactly what these ecologies, these technologies produce in terms of power, for example, what they allow or facilitate and enable in terms of rationales for violence, hence my book, Death Machines, and what sort of knowledge this ecology also produces. In this, I'm particularly interested in emerging technologies and digital technologies. Specifically here, I'll talk about artificial intelligence, as AI and algorithmic powers are heralded to make great strides in all socio-political spheres that we find ourselves. So take, for example, the labor market, where very bleak forecasts have us see about 80% of all our jobs, of most of jobs, digitized and perhaps outsourced through artificial intelligence. These are pessimistic forecasts, but what is certain is that the labor market will be shaken up in significant events or in significant ways by artificial intelligence. Similarly, financial markets, right? So not only high frequency trading and algorithmic decision making in financial markets, but also artificial intelligence and algorithmic decision making structures are used to blacklist or exclude certain people from gaining credit simply based on their data, on their purchasing patterns. An area that I'm really concerned with is military advancements. So you have, for example, the military defense agencies, but primarily the US agency, seeking to engage artificial intelligence to more swiftly and more efficiently identify targets. And this is the logo for the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. And this is the official logo for this project, MAVEN, where they seek to harness the power of artificial intelligence to more quickly identify potential targets through facial recognition software, but other artificial intelligence means to sift through tons and tons of data to find the right target more swiftly. And it's a little bit ridiculous that these like jolly robots announce that we're here to help. So there's something in the air about artificial intelligence where there's a ubiquity about this. We know this from our own social and economic environment. You know, you have Alexa. I don't know how many of you have one of those systems at home that you can just ask to play a piece of music, play my favorite piece of music, and then whatever Alexa thinks is your favorite piece of music will come back at you. But also things like self-driving cars, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem really is that there are webs of artificial intelligence, webs of data power or digital power and algorithmic power that are woven all around us. To the point where we can't necessarily see these as tools, but rather something in its own right, if you will, right? So artificial intelligence, as such, is a buzzword and a technological development which is presently cast as the ultimate game changer for economy and society. A technology of which we can't necessarily be the master, but which nonetheless, and this is a quote from a film called Do You Trust Your Computer? Chris Payne, which is on artificial intelligence, AI will touch literally everything. So the fast pace with which this multi-billion dollar industry advances towards the creation of human level intelligence is accompanied by an increasingly exaggerated chorus for the incredible miracle that AI will constitute or the incredible horrors that intelligent machines will pose for us, for humanity. So proponents claim consistently that AI will save the world from ourselves by making everything better, faster, smarter, more efficient, from medicine to agriculture to business to war. There's some truth to that, but perhaps it's worthwhile looking a bit more carefully. Voices urging caution are harder to hear, usually silenced by some sort of duress to keep up with the rest of the world, to keep up with China, or they're mitigated in some way by finding a technological solution for making AI more ethical or politically aware, which is a strange and amorphous concept to date. So as is the case with many new digital type technologies, innovation, or rather the production of new technological artifacts, outpaces the considerations as to what they might actually be used for, or indeed what kind of problem they might address. A different title for my talk was, if AI is the solution, then what is the problem? And that indeed is a question that remains unanswered. Today, I'm not going to address the many problems that are happening with artificial intelligence and the rapid pace with which it is integrated into our lives, but I want to position artificial intelligence as a technology to be taken seriously, not as a tool, but a social force. So in current narratives, AI is constituted not as a product, mostly, and in the narratives, that is, but as a Promethean actor in its own right, an intelligent agent with the capacity to autonomously build a new and brave future within which humans are destined to be configured as a functional or a data component at best, a relic at worst. And so I'm really interested in the way we constitute ourselves or the way we position ourselves as always inferior to these new technologies, these new superhuman technologies, super intelligent technologies, and the pace with which we produce technologies that apparently render us obsolete. And here's where I bring in Günther Anders, because more than half a decade ago, half a century ago, not half a decade ago, ages ago, Günther Anders sketched out this path towards this technological obsolescence. And his work on Promethean shame and Promethean discrepancy, and these are two concepts that I hope I will have enough time to unpack for you today. His work on these two concepts provides an invaluable means with which to recognize and understand the relationship of the modern human to his and her technological products. As one of the foremost critical thinkers on modern technology, not as a social force, but as a world-constituting force, Anders has provided me and other thinkers, I'm not the first one to talk about Anders, with invaluable insights on the modern technological human condition. So I'm hoping I'll get enough time to sketch out his work. A little bit of background, because he will be probably the thinker that you're least familiar with, yet he is one of the Ur-Frankfurt School thinkers. So Günther Anders, born in 1902 in Breslau, lived the ripe age of 90 years old. Here he is on his own, and here he is in his most famous capacity as Hannah Arendt's first husband. This is the main fact that people know about Günther Anders is that he was very briefly married to Hannah Arendt indeed. But there's, of course, much more to Günther Anders than that. He was a student of Heidegger, Cassirer, Husserl, of course. He was a friend of Herbert Marcuse, of course, a friend of Hannah Arendt's as well. So he was deeply embedded in this school of thought, in this context of thought that was first confronted with a more deeply interwoven technological, political, and socioeconomic environment as such. And the fact that he was married to Hannah Arendt is of juicy relevance, but not really of relevance to his work as such. Nonetheless, there are some overlaps. Now, I am only starting. I'm more familiar with Hannah Arendt's work because that's what my book is based on. But I'm getting to know Anders, and the resonances between Arendt and Anders are quite striking. However, he really takes it further as a deep thinker of technology, as a philosopher of technology, and as a philosopher of technology that exceeds Heidegger, in my view, by quite a bit. And he himself levels quite a substantial critique on him. He was also in a constant tryst with Theodor Adorno, who could probably, in relation to his doctorate, best be described as the pesky reviewer too, who always critiques just about anything that could be critiqued, and was, the story goes, somewhat instrumental in denying him his early doctorate when he wanted to do it. But the political context also was not in Anders' favor, as was the rise of the Nazis, and when he was trying to hand in his doctorate, and he's a Jew, he was born as Günther Stern, and he changed his name to Anders. The political context sort of disallowed his thesis to go further. This kind of context made him a little bit more skeptical towards academia, and as a thinker, he's perhaps the most widely, He's a man of many talents, I want to say. He became a journalist, a critic, a poet. He wrote novels. He was an activist. He was a traveler, an observer of his context, right? And so the value that I find in his work is that he looked at technology and the human in a way that science and technology, STS studies, are only now beginning to look at, right? So he was an early thinker of, if you want to call it actor network theory. He considered us to be embedded within the technologies that shape us and that we in turn shape ourselves. Lots of books he's written. This is a novel. This is a sort of like an anti-fascist novel, Die Molossische Katakombe. But the most important work here is the Antiquierte des Menschen, The Obsolescence of Man. And from this work, there are two concepts that I am really interested in and that I've worked with in my book, but also continue to work with. One is Promethean shame, right? So he's interested in our human condition vis-a-vis technology. And he says, we begin from this notion that we are creator of our products, but as we are woven more intricately, as we begin to be titans ourselves, coming from the Promethean myth, we move from a creator to creatum, right? We are no longer just the makers of our tools, of our machines, but we are in turn constituted by ourselves. We're becoming the product of our product. But this is not so simple, he says, because within this resides a sense of shame, because we can never be as perfect as our products. We can never be perfectible. We are fleshly, embodied, messy, uncertain, aleatory types of humans that just cannot live up to the promise of our products. This comes out of a very modern condition of the entwinement of human labor and machine labor. But the question then emerges, what is the human in an ecology of this ever progression of machines, of this ever greater perfection, speed, efficiency of our machines? In turn, we become increasingly fallible, right? We can't solve love. We can't solve awkwardness. We can't solve our own mortality. So our machines are beginning to become an authority, which leads us or leaves us with a certain sense of shame. So he links that to human enhancement, right, human engineering, and that sort of to overcome our bodily fallibility, if you will. And it's a really interesting dialogue with some of the transhumanist discourses. If you look at what's going on there, you know, the fear of mortality. So he's really useful in sort of giving a context to that. But with artificial intelligence, it's not just the mind, the bodies, it is further the minds. The consequence of that is, of course, a decreasing trust in everything human, right? You have a growing techno-authority, you have a desire to want to become product, to want to become technology yourself, and we see that. I see that with AI narratives when it is hailed to really solve the problems of humanity, positing ourselves as probably nothing more than the clump of clay that was forgotten in Epimetheus's workshop in the first place. So there's this strange, and he calls it a schizophrenic acceptance of our own obsolescence towards a technological ecology that takes on greater and greater levels of responsibility and authority. This, however, leads to an asynchronicity of ourselves with our products. And this is where Anders as the moralist, as the activist also comes out. He says, what happens with this underlying Promethean shame is that our products advance at such a pace that we can't quite keep up with our feelings, right? We can produce, but we cannot imagine the outcomes of our products. We can act with our products, but we cannot feel the consequences of our product. So he calls this a Promethean discrepancy, or Gefälle, he calls it. And he was really, this comes out of a deep engagement of his with the nuclear age and the enormous potential for destruction of this nuclear technology. But I use this also to look at the potentially enormous implications of a sort of omnipresent artificial intelligence superstructure or substructure. So this is where I find it very useful, because we can look at the humanism that we do have to assume responsibility, but we must assume responsibility by harnessing our own moral imagination, by trying to actively close this gap, this Promethean discrepancy between making new products and imagining their outcome or their consequences, between acting with the products and between feeling with others, empathy, if you will, the consequences of that. It is in this shortening that moral responsibility really resides. And I think I'll leave it here. I see Ben giving me a side glance. But it's these two concepts that I, to date, have found most useful in my own research. There's, of course, much more to be said, and I look forward to your questions later.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much, Elke. And we're just going to hand over now to Sebastian Schindler from Frankfurt University.
Yeah, good evening, and thank you also from me for the invitation. I will speak about the wife of Günther Anders, who's way more well-known, Hannah Arendt. I think Arendt is a very interesting thinker when it comes to thinking about the crisis of global politics. She is not, or she at least would herself have denied to be a continental philosopher. She made a point out of being not a philosopher, but a theorist, a political theorist. And I she's nonetheless, I think, very relevant to think about the crisis. I originally had thought that I would speak about an aspect of her thinking that's linked to post-truth politics, to the ideology of post-truth, because Arendt has a notion of ideology that is very useful, I think, in thinking about this phenomenon, notion of ideology that's not so much focused on belief, but on disbelief, on emancipation from reality. Anyways, this is not the starting point I take here. I start from somewhere else because I became then very interested in the notion of crisis, which she uses not so often, but uses at the end of her book on totalitarianism, on the origins of totalitarianism. And there she speaks of the crisis of our time, in German, of der Krise, in der wir alle überall leben, the crisis in which we all live and exist everywhere. And this crisis is not related to Trump and Brexit directly, obviously. But it's also not limited to totalitarianism, to the time of Hitler, Stalin, and the totalitarian regimes they established. Rather, when Arendt speaks of crisis, she thinks of a broader phenomenon, a phenomenon that preceded totalitarianism and that existed also afterwards, after totalitarianism, and that enabled this decay, if you want to say so, this development towards this new terrible form of government, totalitarianism. Now, Arendt also emphasized that the crisis wasn't over with the downfall of Stalin and Hitler, that the crisis persisted. And I think that the current success of populist movements points to the fact that some of these enabling conditions are still there. This is why Arendt's reflections on the crisis of our time are so relevant for our understanding of the contemporary crisis. Now, what is that for Arendt? What is the crisis of our time? This crisis has to do a lot with politics, with our capacity to act politically. Arendt's diagnosis goes further than this common declaration of a lacking political will. You hear, for instance, in the halls of the United Nations headquarters. It goes further. It hangs together with our own capacity to practice politics, to engage in politics. For Arendt, this capacity is a great worth. Politics is one of the highest and finest capacities that humans possess. But ask someone who doesn't study political science or someone who does about politics, and the reaction you will get will likely not be very positive. You won't think, when you ask about politics, about the highest and finest capacities of humans. You'll rather think at first about problems, about failures, about power, about personalities, about interests. We usually do not relate to politics in a positive manner, but instead tend to denounce it as something at least difficult, if not dirty, something even a little corrupt, as the problem. Politics, I would say, is often seen as part of the problem, not the solution. Now, Arendt describes this attitude towards politics as a common prejudice, a prejudice linked also to another prejudice, the prejudice against power. And I have a quote here from her book, The Human Condition. "Perhaps nothing in our history," Arendt writes, "has been so short-lived as trust in power. Nothing more lasting than the Platonic and Christian distrust of the splendor attending its space of appearance. Nothing, finally, in the modern age, more common than the conviction that power corrupts." End of quote. Now, Arendt's point is not that this prejudice against politics, the lacking trust in power, is always unjustified. Politics has to date failed to solve some of the great problems of our time, from the change of world climate to to ravaging social injustice across the globe. But Arendt's point is nonetheless that the capacity to act politically is foremost a potential and not a problem. Why do we need politics then? From Arendt's view, we do not need it primarily because of the outcomes it delivers, but because of its inherent qualities. We do not practice politics to achieve some ulterior goals, but we instead practice it for ourselves. In the experience of acting together, everybody can make his or her own uniqueness, who's his or her own unique personality, his or her own unique potential, visible, make it appear. The appearance of distinct personalities is a virtue of politics, not its vice. However, Arendt maintains that we moderns have somehow lost contact with the experience of politics. In a modern mass societies, individuals tend to conceive of themselves as isolated from each other. At least the dominant normative logic of our time, which is arguably an economic logic, tends to establish relationships of competition between individuals. Think of your own experience of pursuing a university degree, and you will certainly know that competition is a source not only of enormous productivity, but also of isolation. In Arendt's analysis, isolation is a prerequisite for the turn to populism and, in the end, even totalitarianism. Isolated individuals lack the experience of acting together. They lack the experience that in acting together, something greater is established than a mere addition of individual capacities. In acting together, a tremendous power can be created, a power that enables something that doesn't threaten, but enables the appearance of individual persons. Totalitarianism was, for Arendt, foremost a form of government that sought to destroy this individuality. Yet against the image of the totalitarian mass movement, where all individuals speak with one voice, Arendt did not articulate a denunciation of courage, power, and politics. For true courage, true power, and true politics does not eradicate the individual, it brings to the fore its highest potentials. The crisis of our time consists foremost in the lack of spaces for experiencing, for making appear courage, power, and politics. The crisis consists in kind of a disappearance of politics. This disappearance manifests itself in several beliefs, beliefs like the one that there is no alternative to economic management, to increasing wealth and securing growth. The disappearance of politics manifests itself also in the seductiveness of the current populist movements. I think isolated individuals, if you want so, are particularly easily seduced to the promises that populists make. The crisis that we experience today, if we view it from Ireland, is thus not really a crisis of politics. The crisis is that we have lost our access to politics. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. Okay, next up, Ute Steiger.
Thank you. Good evening. Thanks, Ben, for having us tonight. I'm keenly aware I'm the third German to speak tonight and the third to mention Hannah Arendt. I don't want to read too much into this, but there's clearly something about Arendt that stimulates the imagination, if you like. And that's interesting because she wasn't necessarily someone to provide solutions, I should think, to global crisis and global politics, but somebody who rather asked questions. But it's these questions that seem very pertinent to us today still. So hoping not to repeat too much of things that Sebastian's already referred to, I want to have a look at the role of passions and emotions and politics that she discussed with specific reference to today's populist movements. So a very quick, say, introduction or scene setting. How can we define populism? I think there's various categories that are being thrown around, but one key would be that rather than a particular ideological stance, what characterizes populist movements or political parties is the argument of this being a rejection of the elite, the establishment, on the part of what are conceived of as a pure and homogeneous people. Therefore, quite logically, legitimacy for any kind of politics is derived from popular sovereignty and majority rule. True politics then becomes an expression of the general will, la volonté générale, the will of the people. And I think we've heard quite a lot about the will of the people in this country in the last 2 years. And another, I suppose, aspect of this is that probably quite legitimately an anger against the depoliticization of quite a lot of areas of policy making and political decision making, hence the slogan, we've had enough of experts. But arguably there's another aspect to this, and which is that populist, how should we say it, way of doing politics seems to challenge what has been quite a dominant normative paradigm, I think, that undergirds liberal democracies. And that is the understanding of politics as a process of, let's say, unbiased deliberation, informed by moral judgment, striving for fair redistribution and adjudication. Suffice it to say that I think politics these days doesn't really seem like a process of measured preference formation. That's obviously Brexit and Trump, but it goes back much further. Think of the German neologism, the Wutbürger, the angry citizen. Similarly, the Spanish indignados, quite a few years back now, or the interlocutors of that famous French book, Indignez-vous, you know, time for outrage. It really seems to me that we live in a time of anger rather than a sort of unbiased compromise and negotiation. So shutting out affect from politics is probably something that's neither theoretically nor practically easy to do, but it is obviously also a rather precarious equilibrium. How can we think about the right role, if you like, of emotions in politics? And that's where Arendt comes in. She's quite an unorthodox thinker, and she's dedicated a lot of her thinking on modern condition of politics by going back to historical instances, including the American and French revolutions, 19th and 20th century uprisings in Europe, or the American civil disobedience movements in the 1960s. But on the basis of these examples, she's usually seen to construct a very purist theory of political action. Usually you look at one of her big books on revolution, where she discusses specifically the American and French revolutions. And she compares them as sort of, I don't want to say archetypes, but very, very clear examples of a different way of doing things. The American Revolution for her was a very successful, within its limits, a quite successful event. It was coterminous with new political institutions being created, institutions which expanded, in principle at least, the participation of citizens in politics. The French Revolution, instead, she argued, failed. And why? It was because it wasn't directed at creating new political institutions, but towards ameliorating the suffering of the masses of the poor. The people, le peuple, became equivalent to the unfortunate ones, les malheureux. And the legitimacy of their representatives then sort of relied specifically on a compassionate feeling, on elevating compassion indeed to the supreme political virtue. This distinction that she draws rests on quite a controversial difference between what she calls the private realm, marked by necessity, by the social needs, by our needs to eat and work and look after the family, and the public realm, which liberates, according to her, citizens from such necessities. It's a very narrow definition of true political action, and one that focuses quite exclusively on the terms of debate and deliberation itself. So in terms of format, she then worries that politics infused with passions shuns negotiation and persuasion. In terms of substance, she worries that we care too much about social concerns rather than about the pure ideals of politics itself. But it's not really as simple as that, because it wouldn't really give us very much to think about if she just sided with the rational side of things. If you dig a little deeper into her works, you find more interesting thoughts that I think are worth exploring. And let me just pick out, if I have time, four key points. The first is actually that she very specifically says that the idealization, not just of emotion, but also of reason in politics, is dangerous. She, in fact, critiques explicitly the what she calls age-old model of the rule of the reasons over the passions, which she thought was a thought dear to the Enlightenment, which was quickly found wanting. Instead, she said, and that is from Men in Dark Times, she said, and I quote, "The rationalism and sentimentalism of the 18th century are only two aspects of the same thing. Both could equally lead to that enthusiastic excess in which individuals feel ties of brotherhood to all men." So it isn't as easy as to say, if only we could ever go back to the reason in politics and all would be good and safe. It is really a much more complicated picture than that. So her key concern in this, then, is about the destructiveness of collective affect in sustaining what she called, following Rousseau and Robespierre, the will of the people. For her, affect, personal affect, really is what mobilizes the political, arms the political weapon that mobilizes both the mob and the elite, and suppresses, and that's a key point, plurality in the name of the will of the people. So Sebastian's already sort of referred to this, but the idea that Rousseau had about the volonté générale is not that it is the expression of political freedom. It's quite the opposite. It undoes its prerequisite. It really reduces the exchange and plurality of opinion, of deliberation, and of consent. It is about really identifying one's own will with the will of the people. Il faut une volonté une, a single will of the people. And that is really what Arendt always argued against most strongly. Interestingly, she also picks up that Rousseau didn't seem to care very much in which way it went. It didn't really matter whether it would be a republican will or a royalist will, as long as the will of the people was united. And I think we find sometimes today some of them of a similar similarity, if you like, between one extreme of the political spectrum and the other. But Arendt does accord a role to the emotions in political participation. It's not about excising them at all. She actually says, and that's in On Violence, she says, in order to respond reasonably, one must first of all be moved. And the opposite of emotional is not rational, whatever that may mean, but either the inability to be moved, usually pathological phenomenon, or sentimentality, which is a perversion of feeling. This is not about bringing your innermost motivations out into the light of the public realm, enticing as that might sound, but she sort of tries to establish some sort of classification under which affects and emotions could play a role. First, she distinguishes passion, take the example of compassion, which is directed, really, she says, at individuals only, and thus, in principle, irrelevant for politics. And then she distinguishes that from sentiment, which she identifies as pity, and which is exactly what she calls a perverted feeling. And that's what she accuses both Rousseau and Robespierre of manipulating. Instead of either of these two, the perverted, sort of manipulated sentiment, or the original, very private emotion, she proposes what she calls a principle. And her example for this would be solidarity, a sort of more abstract, dispassionate way of guiding your motivation towards a political goal. Now, if that sounds like a less than watertight system, that's possibly because it is. She has never been the most coherent and cohesive of philosophers. And in her Denktagebücher, the thought diaries that she wrote between 1950s and the 1970s, and which I believe have not been published in English, you can follow her struggle to accord emotions a role in politics. In fact, it is quite interesting to see how that famous sort of triad of hers, where she distinguished between work, on the one hand and labor and then political action on the other. It's a triad that has become very kind of associated with the thought. In fact, was originally complemented by a fourth element, that was patein, that was passion to suffer. So it was very much about understanding what role, and she talked about the active relationships between people, how that role might be able to work in politics. And it is very much about the activity or the passivity of that term. We are motivated by what we suffer. To what extent do we actually have a role in driving this forward? To what extent are we absolutely dominated by it and therefore have a passive role? And in that case, this is what she struggled with, finding that particular balance, if you like. And by April 1955, in fact, her diary very clearly shows that she decides to rule out the passions in any shape or form. A fourth point, and I'll be very quick on this, is that she says political action needs to make itself remembered. It needs to endure. It needs active commemoration to retell stories of actions and events in order to function. And it's a very interesting thing, which I won't have time to talk about tonight, but that performative aspect, that aesthetic aspect of her thinking. Politics is something that we go out and do, that we have, in an ideal world, the virtuosity to perform out rather than a teleological activity that leads to a certain end. That is a very difficult thought that in today's sort of post-truth environment really deserves further working out. So, just to conclude, Arendt remains exceedingly controversial, I think, as well as interesting. Let me finish by quoting her on quoting Lessing. She said, "I'm not duty-bound to resolve the difficulties I create. May my ideas always be somewhat disjunct or even appear to contradict one another, if only they are ideas in which readers will find material that stirs them to think for themselves." And that, I think, she does allow us to do today. Thank you.
Okay, Scott Hamilton, Balsillie School.
So hi, everyone. My name is Scott Hamilton. I'm here from Canada. I'm not German. And to start us off, here we have a scene in December from Montreal. 40 centimeters of snow had fallen on the ground, so some mischievous Montrealer took it upon himself to make a car entirely out of snow. And it fooled police, and police were driving by the whole night giving the snow car tickets. Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with my presentation at all. I just thought that with something as intense as crises of global politics and continental philosophy, we all need to lighten up just a little bit every once in a while. So now I'll start getting you down. My presentation is entitled, "I Am Uncertain, But We Are Not: Heidegger, the Anthropocene, and the Need for Certainty." And what I'm going to do is just look at a very small intersection of Heidegger's thought and this concept of the Anthropocene. It's not a general overview of both because they're gigantic topics in themselves. I have a large, convoluted paper that I've written for this event. If anyone wants to reach out and read it after, I'm always welcome to hear your thoughts. So diving right in, we are in some serious trouble. We are on the verge of a global ecological collapse. And right now, climate change tends to get the majority of the attention, right? The level of CO2 in the atmosphere is higher than it's been in about a million years. NASA, in May 2018, documented CO2 concentrations at 408 parts per million, and that portends an approximate rise of global average temperature 3 to 5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. So that's enough to get you down. But the climate system, the atmospheric system, is just one of many Earth systems, right? And the bad news is they're all in crisis. So you have the cryosphere, which is ice. So you have the decline of Arctic sea ice, the shattering of the Western Antarctic ice sheet. You have the hydrosphere, which is water, right? So not only are certain areas of the world supposed to have their sea level rise approximately 8 feet by 2040, some areas of the world, due to monsoon patterns, but we also have, after that, the lithosphere, and the lithosphere is land. So what are we doing to the land? Right now we're accumulating certain things like plastics. From nuclear tests, we have what's called carbon-14 radioactive nuclides that actually make a firm deposit over the surface of the Earth. And of course, look at cities, look at the amount of concrete we're producing. And humanity right now as a forest actually moves more land than the Earth does itself right now. So humanity moves more Earth than the planet does. And there's one more system, and that is, could be the most important one, that's the biosphere, the sphere of life. And right now we're actually entering the Earth's sixth mass extinction, where the Earth's extinction rates have gone up 100 to 1,000 times the natural background average, depending on the area. And it actually rivals the KT extinction of the Cretaceous period, which, as some of you might know, is what killed the dinosaurs. So humanity is now killing as much life as a giant asteroid impact did. Yay, now you know why I started with a snow car. It can get you down. So what does this mean? Scientists are telling us that humanity has destroyed the Earth to such a substantial extent, we're actually entering our own geological epoch. And it's called the Anthropocene Epoch. So it's a new period in Earth history, where hypothetically, let's say you're an alien and you come down to Earth a million years from now, you'll actually be able to detect a specific geological layer in the Earth's strata where you have before humans and after humans. There's actually a discernible change in the quality of the Earth. And on top of stratigraphy, you have Earth system scientists, which they take those five systems, they throw them together, and they say, we, humanity, we're changing the constitution of the planet in basic and fundamental ways. So why is that important, right? Why should we care? There's a big football game on in a couple days. I'm glad to be in England for that. We should care because the past 11,500 years, we've been living in what's called the Holocene epoch. And what that is a period of very relative stability all across the globe. So you have familiar cycles of rainfall, of wind, of soil erosion. And what you can do in periods of relative stability, if you're a species like humanity, is that you can do things like start agriculture. You can build civilizations. So this is really important because what the Anthropocene portends for all of us is a basic, foundational, fundamental change in all of the preconditions for everything we know. So it's kind of a big deal. Again, you think about it a lot, you research it every day, it can get you down. So there are two ways in the literature of generally thinking about the Anthropocene epoch, right? We're in academia, there's debates over everything every day. So what are, very generally put, the debates are between what are called new anthropocentrists, guys like Clive Hamilton, and they go all in with the human being. They say human beings started this problem, the only way we're gonna get out of it is by acknowledging the special place that humans have in nature, and hoping humans can get us out of it. So quote from Clive, the kind of humanized Earth we now live on is what we always had to fear, the one made by the misuse of our creative powers. Indeed, the capricious and uncontaminable power of nature always threatens to come roaring into action should we push it too hard, as we now have. And against the new anthropocentrists, you have what are known as post-humanists. And post-humanists generally say, get rid of that whole binary between humanity and nature. It's a false dichotomy. Humans are actually entangled with every other creature in the biosphere. So you have to get rid of that Cartesian division. So a line from post-humanism, global ecological collapse brings new urgency to the claim that we are all in this together. Humans, animals, ecologies, biosphere, we cannot survive without accepting the cosmopolitan and enmeshed nature of this world. We are an array of bodies connected and interconnected in complex ways that have little to do with nationality. So, this is an ongoing debate, but a strange component of this debate comes through when you ask, well, what do both of these perspectives share? And it actually shares this notion of a planetary humanity known as the we, right? Like we are causing climate change, we are causing the Anthropocene. But what exactly is the we? Is it just an obscure discursive slip that comes up in the literature, or is it something more significant? So that's what I looked at in this paper. And in order to look at it, I did not go to Arendt, although she's great. I looked at Martin Heidegger's work. And more specifically, he actually gives a philosophical account of the we back in the 1950s and 60s in the collection of essays, Question Concerning Technology, where what he does is relate the nature of certainty and truth, subjectivity, and technology all into one package, and he traces it historically. So I'll just cover the very bare bones of this right now, because anyone who's read Heidegger knows it's kind of heavy stuff. For Heidegger, it all boils down to what he calls, I guess in ancient Greek or Latin, the subjectum. We know it as the subject, as subjectivity, right? I have a subjectivity, you have a subjectivity, and what we do as thinking beings with a subjectivity is that we go out into the world and we deal with objects, right? So I'm going to go and I'm going to move this lectern or do whatever. But Heidegger actually, in a very pre-Foucauldian way, looks at the metaphysical constitution of what this concept of the subject is, the subjectum. He goes all the way back to ancient Greece, and he finds that, well, they had no concept of subjectivity like we did. The I was not the human being. There was no I. The subjectum was actually that which was lying out before something. So Heidegger talks a lot in his very abstruse and difficult language about the way things presence, and they become unconcealed through things like phusis. You can imagine a flower opening unto itself, or poesis, which is when, let's say, a sculptor takes a block of rock and carves out a flower. So these are all ways of what Heidegger considers a truth. Truth is how being is revealed for a particular subject. For the Greeks, the subject was that outline before something. And it's pretty much the same with the medieval Christians as well, except here, the subjectum, the subject, that which is lying before someone, is actually in church doctrine. What are you certain of? You're certain of salvation. And your truth in the Middle Ages isn't derived from any connection of yourself as a subjectivity, reconciling yourself with objects in the world. That still did not exist. For the medieval Christians, truth came from comparing the divine word that was in certain texts with church doctrine and, let's say, the acts of people around you. So when does this all change? Heidegger goes to Descartes, right, and says, with Descartes, the cogito ergo sum, you have the placement of certainty, the subjectum. It's taken from outside in the world. It's no longer from poesis or the Greek notion of apprehending. It's no longer from church doctrine. What Descartes does is take this notion of subjectivity and he puts it inside the person. So now what am I certain of? I am certain of myself. I am a subject, and I am now certain that I can look out at objects in the world and I can do things like measure them, the distance between myself as an object, and I can look at relationships between them. And that grants us, as we've seen in quote-unquote modernity, I use that term very lightly, a tremendous amount of power, and also causes a tremendous amount of destruction. Heidegger calls it Gestell. Instead of the opening of, let's say, a flower into being, into presence, now humanity is challenging forth objects. When you're a subject, you have the freedom and agency to call forth things, to go into the world and do things. So how does this relate to technology? Well, Heidegger describes that notion of subjectivity that we have, the classical Cartesian subjectivity, is actually just how technology operates. So the essence of technology is nothing technological. It's kind of a famous Heideggerianism. And what that means is that technology reveals the world to us in a very specific way. It doesn't allow it just to come forth, but what it does is that Heidegger describes it as an object sphere. So imagine kind of a blank canvas, and then draw a little square on it, an object sphere. And what that allows you to do is now to define things within it, to measure their relationship, to see how they're interrelated. And once you do that, you can go to smaller and smaller and smaller object spheres. And that's essentially how science works, right? You come up with your hypothesis, your research plan, you dig into the nature of being, you find a result, and you just keep going down and down and down. And you don't have to be a quantum physicist, right, to grasp that. So here you have the classical metaphysical eye. You have your scientific representation of being, that little box, where you can essentially create your object sphere. And the deeper you go down, the more it expands. The more kind of technological repercussions boil out from that. And Heidegger calls this as inframing. The danger is, the deeper down you go, subjectivity can never reconcile itself with the object. You just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. And Heidegger warns, if you go deep enough, you're actually going to lose that object. You're going to be grasping at nothing. And if you lose the object, you lose yourself. You lose the I. You become what he calls objectlessness. And we get this in the notion of a system. He says this is a system. So technological systems, in the metaphorical sense, are exactly this. And I'll read this very quickly. He quotes, man as a rational being of the age of the Enlightenment is no less subject than is man who grasps himself as a nation, wills himself as a people, fosters himself as a race, and finally empowers himself as lord of the earth. Subjective egoism, for which mostly without knowing it the I is determined beforehand as subject, can be canceled out through the insertion of the I into the we. So where does that take us with the Anthropocene? Where does the Anthropocene come from? So the Anthropocene is actually loosely based on climate models. And climate model is known as a general circulation model, a GCM. What a climate model is, in case anyone's unfamiliar with it, is you can imagine the Earth as a sphere. What you do is you take a series of boxes. And within that box, you calculate as much as you possibly can. You take every aspect of the Earth and you calculate not just longitude and latitude, but moisture content, wind content, you know, the amount of sunlight that's getting in. You calculate how that square mixes up all those things together and how that square interacts with every other square going around the entire Earth. And the better the science gets, the smaller the squares get. And that's essentially how climate models work. A better climate model means smaller squares. Endless, endless, endless amounts of calculation. And the nature of climate models today is that they can no longer be calculated by a human being. They're too complex. We're entirely dependent on these supercomputers to essentially tell us what the climate is. So how many of you have ever reached out and touched the global climate? It's actually a fairly recent phenomenon. Now, back in the 50s and 60s, we didn't conceive of the climate as something global. It's actually a technological development that emerged in the 70s and 80s from incredible advances in computer technology. And wrapping up, well, what is Earth system science that brings the Anthropocene into being? The very nature of it is, instead of just the climate system, it's every system, including humanity. You are put into Earth system science, put together and calculated. And that's how we are portending this future of the Anthropocene. So is that the reality of the Earth system science? Is it this objectlessness? Because the way that a subjectivity exists in the world and derives certainty for itself is by being able to represent objects back to itself. But in something as large and as complex as the Anthropocene, there's no object to represent back. It's just endless calculations. It's objectlessness. And on top of that, you consider the nature of geological time, right? How long does a human being live? We can think about decades, we can think about centuries. How do you put a human being into a geological epoch that's 3 million years? There's no I. There's just endless expanses of time. And it seems that the only way that people are falling back on it now is through that concept of the we, right? This is what we are doing. We becomes the ground for certainty, the new subjectum. So two quick examples, if anyone's ever read Dipesh Chakrabarty or Clive Hamilton, they're brilliant, but they're both going all in with this notion of a planetary humanity. We can only think about ourselves as a species now. And in the Anthropocene, humankind became a unified entity, the Anthropos, the central agent on a new kind of Earth, one delimited by the power of the Earth system, right? So our only certainty now is not in any specific object, but it's just in the science, it's in the calculations. So to conclude, if we take away anything, one is that it's not just climate change we have to worry about. That's just one system of many. We are entering, some claim, the Anthropocene. There's a whole big argument going into that. The Anthropocene, it hints at a new form of certainty and subjectivity. How do you reconcile yourself to that amount of systemic calculation, to that objectlessness, to that notion of geological time? The implications. There are many. One is, obviously, if you subscribe to any religion or culture or language or group, if you fought for rights as a group, you just get swallowed up. You get lost. And a lot of these authors just admit that. They say, oh, that's the way it is. So I want to be clear. Implication two is I'm not saying I'm for this, but there is a tendency to think this in literature, right? So if you think about, let's say, the old philosophy of Werner Heisenberg, fellow German, one of his great quotes was that every concept, every tool carries with it the spirit with which it was created. So the Anthropocene is something created through these endless series of computations and calculations in which the human itself gets lost, right? What is left at the end, it's only just the we. And I have a bunch of stuff on identity politics about this, but I'm out of time, so I'll have to leave that until the end. As you can see, all the slides I didn't get to. But thank you very much for your time, and bring it home.
Thank you, Scott. We'll hand over now to our discussant, Josephine Grafe.
Right. I promise I'll be the last German speaker for today. Sorry about that. Right, I'll try to get through this quickly so we have enough time for discussion. So the question at the heart of our discussion here tonight is whether the work of great European philosophers can help us to solve Europe's problems today, perhaps even global problems. Now, as Uta mentioned already, it is not usually the task of philosophers to provide answers to pressing political questions, but with the reflection on the world that we inhabit and the complexity of the human condition, they help us to ask the questions that we need to ask before we can even hope to come up with answers that will be, in any case, only provisional. So reading the papers that were presented tonight and listening to the comments just now, I was struck by how the speakers all seem to address three interrelated tensions that seem to shape the current crisis of European and global politics. The first one is a tension between the loss of our capacity and willingness, perhaps also, to act politically, as Sebastian said, and the growing realization that, as Scott explained with reference to the concept of the Anthropocene, we are challenged to conceive of a new political subject, a collective planetary group, a unified whole, in order to assess the effects of our social and economic interaction on ourselves. And as the speakers have pointed out, the approach to politics as a problem itself and as a perhaps disposable human activity, or perhaps something that we leave to machines to take care of, has potentially catastrophic consequences, a loss of space for self-reflection, for self-realization, for deliberation, imagination, and moral action. And this leads to a set of questions. What does it mean to have agency and to act politically in a globalized world whose perception, our perception of it, is transformed both temporally and spatially by technological innovation and the availability of more and more, as Scott said, knowledge about our own condition, more than we are capable of processing and comprehending? Is it possible to create a more inclusive political we, acting jointly together in order to achieve humans' highest potentials and best qualities, as Aaron said? Or are we stuck with a political dynamic that mobilizes the masses through emotional appeals and pits one we against another in a counter-reaction to the disappearance of the I as a certain political subject in the Anthropocene? Or is it perhaps that what we are currently witnessing is a transitory phase, at whose end there will be a brighter future for all humanity? That takes me to the second tension at the paper's address, which is the one between, on the one hand, the growing and intensifying networks between people worldwide through new communication technologies and human-machine interactions, and, on the other hand, the disintegration of human relations. As Alka explained in her talk, we cannot act politically if we lose the capacity to take responsibility for ourselves and for others, because we cannot keep pace with our own technological products and data supply. Being in control of ourselves and taking responsibility, however, requires imagination, it requires empathy, morality, and human capacities that cannot be outsourced to machines. This, of course, is then the other positive role of emotions and politics, as Uta's talk indicated. So the breakdown of relations between human beings as political beings is simultaneously then, in addition to the technological dimension of things, promoted by populist politics as apolitical politics. Populist politics is apolitical because it does not simply suggest that there is an authentic will of the people, but exactly one authentic will. That's a very important distinction. It is precisely not a volonté générale, but a non-falsifiable will of an imaginary particular people predetermined by someone else that requires constant public performance through plebiscitarian linkages. Now, what that means can be seen in the many referenda that have been held and the polls that have been conducted in Europe over the past few years, including Brexit. They were not, in fact, meant as a tool to give citizens a chance to deliberate and express their, if you like, majoritarian will and hence exercise their popular sovereignty. They were a means to perform the people as a political subject to be represented by a different group of political actors, but a group of political actors nonetheless, who had already decided what their will should be. And even elections are now declared to be plebiscitarian actions. For example, on welfare policy and immigration, we see that being announced by the Sweden Democrats. In Sweden, the general elections in September this year, but also in Bavaria and Germany, and the regional elections in the same month, they have declared those elections to be plebiscitarian actions with regards to immigration welfare policy. And these shifts towards the people's will preempt the authentic attempts at improving public deliberation, while they also at the same time move responsibility away from politicians who have become less trusted to make competent decisions in light of a global world increasingly perceived as we heard, uncertain. So populist politics, therefore, is not a form of authentic politics, to use Aaron's term, because it does not provide more opportunities for ordinary citizens to participate in politics. It does not promote debate in the public realm. And this raises the question if there can be the notion of in notion of the people that is authentically inclusive instead of exclusive. Can there be a global people? Can there be ties of brotherhood, and sisterhood, I suppose, between all men and women, to quote Arendt again? Can passion and reason, emotion and rationality, as Uta outlined, be balanced in a way that allows us to act collectively in the pluralist and liberal fashion? Can the concept of the people be stretched so far as to transform it into a hyper-inclusive we that is able to respond to the uncertainties of the Anthropocene? This takes me to the third and final tension addressed by the four papers, namely the tension between the new assertiveness that is particularly reflected in populist politics and the growing uncertainty about humanity's future. Our uncertainty, as Elgin Scott discussed, stems from humans' essential vulnerability, their being towards death, to speak with Heidegger, and which we are indeed trying to cure by developing new, more innovative technologies at an ever greater pace, while ignoring that there can never be absolute certainty. In fact, both Earth system science and artificial intelligence intensify feelings of not being in control, of being unable to comprehend, as the speaker said. Technology then becomes a quasi-human, while humans become quasi-machines, vulnerable clumps of clay, as Elgar said. And this leads us to the paradox that we become more aware of uncertainty as we try to reduce it through technological innovation and the collection of big data, which consequently then makes us more uncertain and vulnerable. In the political realm, this finds its expression in the rise of a populist politics that is not, as I said, interested in authentic deliberation and the ambiguity and unpredictability of political agency that is built into that process of deliberation. Instead, it suggests that both can be eliminated from democratic politics altogether by simply implementing the will of an imaginary majority. And both of these dynamics, to conclude, challenge us to rethink, as Scott suggests, the very notion of uncertainty as something that is ineliminable part of our collective future. So responding to today's crisis of European global politics, I suggest, requires us to look closer at these three tensions that the four papers presented today addressed. The tension between our growing inability and the growing necessity to act politically, the tension between the growth of human networks and human-machine interactions on the one hand and the breakdown of human relationships on the other, and between the rise of a new political assertiveness and a growing and partially self-produced uncertainty. And as we do so, we should bear in mind that one of my favorite continental philosophers, Paul Ricoeur, said that the moral law commands us to make the highest possible good in a world the final object of all our conduct.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you very much, Josie. We have 20 minutes left for a Q&A session. What I'm going to suggest is that we take the questions in rounds so we can hear from as many of you as possible. We've got roving mics, so if you just put your hand up, wait for the mic to arrive, and if you could identify yourself as well, because this will be on the podcast. So, any questions for our speakers? Gentlemen up here.
Thank you very much. Great session there. Congratulations. Very good. Identify myself. I'm Michael Brown. I'm not a student. I run an advertising agency. I've got two questions, really, and one is for you, Scott. I'm sorry, I'm hogging the limelight, aren't I, if I ask two. One is, in an age that you describe as, you know, we lose our subjectivity, we become the we instead of the I, what happens, and I'm asking this seriously, to a competition like the World Cup? So, because, you know, that competition that drives capitalism doesn't end and could be seen to drive progress, so what happens to progress after we are the we? And then the other one was about the will of the people, and can we accurately define, this was for loads of the speakers, can we accurately define what that is? Because the will of the people could also be described as the person who shouts the loudest. So how do we accurately identify what is the will of the people? That'd be it. Thank you.
Okay, more questions, please? At the back there.
Thank you for sharing all those lovely thoughts. I had a question for Sebastian, actually. And you mentioned the disappearance of politics as us acting collectively and how we no longer do that. And so I just wanted to particularly point out globalization and say, well, actually, now we should, in theory, feel less isolated because our work means so much more. Rather, my work that I do today impacts someone across the world. So how can we then say that isolation is the foundation of populism?
Thank you very much. Any questions from down here? In the front there.
I just want to ask if I disappear from our lexicon, who will take responsibility? Like if you replace I with we. And especially, we are creating 5D printing software, so it's a very important question for us, like the responsibility.
Okay, we'll take one final question. Okay, we got a question over there at the back, please, Joseph.
Thank you very much. I just wondered if you could speak to the Cartesian dualism where the we versus I is kind of the new, like, Heidegger's position, but Arendt's statements around the abstract nakedness of being human, where our identity is really found in kind of that state identity or in having that collective, you sort of only are who you are because of that particular collective and that being where you can find yourself, whereas humanity might be something that leaves you vulnerable and isolated. So how do we become that we? So that's sort of that conversation between Arendt and maybe Heidegger on that point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So we'll go through in the order that we had the presentations. If you'd just like to respond to any questions, but no more than 2 minutes, please.
I'm going to take a question on the responsibility. I mean, I have a word or two to say about Arendt, but I'm going to leave that to tonight's Arendt experts. You ask who will take responsibility. My question is, who is responsible? So the question is, of course, the two questions are related. Now, Anders would say that through the diffusion and the sort of dispersion of roles, right? So somebody puts the machine together, another one programs the machine, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long distancing between what each individual participant towards a technological system does and the outcome of the system. This all contributes to this greater discrepancy and this greater sort of Promethean discrepancy that he talks about, that it becomes increasingly difficult for anybody to take responsibility because nobody is aware of what the response will be, right? So it's a diffusion of tasks which collectively will lead to an outcome, but nobody really has the capacity to fully see the whole picture. That's a problem for Anders. However, I will go ahead and ask a question, and I ask this in the context of commercial AI or commercial software and commercial technology as well as military technology. Who is responsible? Now, what we have to keep in mind that in my talk and in my work, I'm concerned about AI. These are products. Somebody produces them, and they serve somebody's interest, usually a handful of vested interests. So I think rather than thinking this becomes our natural habitat, which it does become, of course, but there is a maxim, and this maxim is underwritten by somebody who has interest in it, and within that resides a possibility, responsibility that I think we should be politically tasked to challenge that, right, or to at least put a formal framework of responsibility to those who produce the technologies that make it
less and less possible for individuals to take responsibility. So I, you know, it sort of goes into the we and I discussion, or I and we discussion as well. I mean, it depends on really what we're talking about. For the purposes of technology as a product, we mustn't forget that these things are product, not nature, not given, and therein lies our capacity or our chance to ask people to take responsibility in that sense.
Thank you. Sebastian.
Yeah, thank you. I think I'll just speak about this question about globalization and the links that do exist, of course. And I think what's important here is to think about the quality of the links to other people, of course. And Arendt's point is very much that there's very different kinds of relating, of course, that we have been speaking about here in the front as well to other people, and that political action is a very fine and noble way of relating to other people, and that maybe doesn't take place so much through the globalization, globalized economy, globalized practices that you spoke of. I mean, one has to look at the detail here, of course, of how this is practiced in the end. I think that the point is really to ask ourselves sometimes, why do we do this, actually? And do we do it to achieve some kind of growth or some kind of benefit that is realized only in the future? Or do we basically engage in a practice that has its value in the moment itself where you do it? And where are these spaces of political action today? I think one can find them. They have not entirely disappeared, but we have to when we follow Arendt's inspiration, we kind of ask a different question, see a different value, I think, also in the things we do.
Thank you. About the will of the people, then. Well, I think that's precisely the problem. How to identify what the will of the people is precisely where Arendt comes in, because she suggests, and quite persuasively so, that there isn't such a thing as a unified will of the people. In fact, what the problem is with any attempt to establish it is that it's precisely about generating it. So Rousseau thought that the only way that a will of the people that's unified can emerge is by counterposing it to something else. Usually that's done in the realm of foreign affairs, i.e. the enemy. The enemy is what then makes us as a people cohere and create a common position. But he goes further than that and actually says that in a proper nation, what happens is that the particular will of each individual citizen becomes the problem. He talks about the fact that it's within our own soul, our own torn soul, that we have to identify the enemy within, if you like, in order to become and overcome everybody's particular will so as to identify entirely with that of the society at large. And so instead of creating a dialogue between different positions and deliberating between them, it becomes a question of suppressing, if you like, one's own interests, one's own positions, in order to arrive at that will. And therefore, what Arendt fears most, of course, is not public opinion, but the unanimity of public opinion. And that's actually one of the things that she also discusses in the context of the American Revolution, saying that's what the Founding Fathers feared most. It was the unanimity of a public opinion. So it's about, if you like, the generating, the manipulating of an opinion that is then posited as the one single expression of what the people want, and both conceptions fail, the idea of that there being one single people with a one single will. And I think, you know, I have to make that Brexit reference, of course. People voted for Brexit, fine, but they didn't really vote for what kind of Brexit they wanted, and it's the government's interpretation of what the people wanted that have led us to where we are today.
Thank you very much for your questions. Getting off to the first question, which was World Cup. Yes, topical. With any Heideggerian work, and especially Foucauldian work, I think we have to appreciate the historical gymnastics that you actually have to indulge in to kind of get what they're saying, right? Like, you can't just go back and read Plato's Republic. I once had a philosophy prof say it takes like 15 years of active thought and research to actually get a little bit inside their head. So, for example, you go into the British Museum and you look at this work of the ancient Greeks, and take, for example, cause and effect. That's so basic for us, right? We don't even have to think about it. We breathe it. Well, the ancient Greeks had no conception of cause and effect. They had a completely different metaphysics of truth, of science and being. So they had the matter, which is what the thing was made of, the form into which the shape occupies, the end goal that thing was being made for, and the person that was making it. And those four aspects of reality were tied together, and they were co-responsible for bringing this thing into the world and kind of instructing how it was going to be used. That was their causality, right? And that's so different than what we have today. And so when we think about the way our subjectivity is shaped today as a particular individual I, it takes serious mental gymnastics to imagine, well, what could, let's say, ancient Greek what could their self be like? You know, if you're a pious medieval Christian when your entire order is shaped around living and breathing church doctrine, like, what would that be like? It's so difficult to even come close to imagining, and then that's where the work comes in, right? So I think that's the most important, just generally trying to get to a couple questions there. I'm not advocating for the we. I can't say what it would be like, because we're always still standing on the shores of our own kind of Cartesian subjectivity. We just see weird signs of it starting to crop in subtle places. But as for the World Cup, getting back to that, Heidegger is very clear that any form of groupism or collectivism, that actually intensifies subjectivity. So I think World Cup would get more and more and more intense, but people would be living and breathing their nation like they live and breathe themselves right now. If anyone, maybe you want to sacrifice yourself for your nation in the World Cup, I don't know. I have no idea, but hypothetically, it could still be there and just as intense. I'll respond to a question up there, just touching on the Arendt Heidegger issue. You know what? I'm going to pass on that one too, with you guys. So.
But I think what you're saying about the football is it's coming home.
Oh yeah, 100%.
We have time. We have 5 minutes left. So if there's any burning questions, yes, the gentleman here, please.
Hi, I'm Phil Drum. I have two questions, one serious and one not so serious. The not serious one, do you think that anyone on the panel deserves the same vote as someone that's in a mental institution? And the serious question is, what do you think about some of the thinkers like Steven Pinker who actually pose a more positive light on some of the crises that you're bringing up?
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the upper levels? Any more questions? Yes, one more question back there, gentleman in the blue shirt. You could just wait for the mic, please.
Does AI exist? Really, AI? Does it really? Are we just talking expert computer systems at present?
Wait, I'll answer.
Okay, right. So we're running out of time, so I think we'll take...
I wanted to ask, really...
Would you like to take the mic, please? Thank you.
I wanted to ask if, given that the Leave campaign argued that they made whatever argument was effective to win, you saw the lie, and then you talk about the manipulation of... could you speak about that with relation to your own individual concepts of truth and where truth comes from and so on, and whether we should not have an objective... shared reality as opposed to the approaches that you're adopting.
Okay, so we have 2 minutes to answer these. So those of you who feel that the question seemed aimed at you, please respond.
did you ask if AI exists? Artificial intelligence? Yeah, as a form of computer science, it has existed for 30 years. It's actually nothing new. It's just a way of making computers develop computational processing where it gets increasingly self-reliant, right? So it was like, okay, you put some data in, then it gets some data out. So there have been some AI winters where
the people who started developing AI, they were like, okay, we'd really love to make thinking machines that act like humans. They ran into all kinds of problems. They stopped developing it. And the reason why we have so much AI hype right now is because there's been recent developments with machine learning and neural networks and that kind of stuff. Now, super intelligent, superhuman artificial intelligence does not quite exist, or artificial general intelligence does not quite exist. But artificial intelligence, it's literally just computational power. And that does exist, yes.
Sure. I'll have a quick response on... It ties into both, actually. Quantification reveals some forms of truth and not others. Right, so you always have to remember that. It's not like climate science and Earth system science is very true. But what it brings into being won't cover certain components of reality. And that's something to keep in mind. And getting back to Pinker, that's what I think makes someone like Pinker fairly dangerous, when they forget that and they think, I am a scientist, therefore what I can bring into being can cover the whole field of reality. And so he skims over a lot of what the essentials are that make us human, which I think crosses the line sometimes with Pinker between dangerous to arrogant.
Okay. So we are sadly out of time. It's been a wonderful event. You might have seen me holding a little card up to our panelists earlier. It's just a note that said, I loved your talk. And I hope you loved their talk as well. So I would ask you to give the panelists a round of applause, please. Thank you very much.